AM 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this afternoon at tsn1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A happy new year, as it is our first show since the start of 2013. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is, and you'll hear from Michael Remus later on during the broadcast. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday afternoon. Joining us momentarily will be Dennis Bayak, live from Ufa, Russia, with a recap of the World Junior Hockey Championships.
Good to have Real Drew back.
Real Drew is back. You guys had fake Drew last week. I had a good chuckle when I heard that, but Real Drew is back. That is me. And also joining us on the show today, James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail. Going to talk some CBA with him. And Grant Saunier, he's an ESPN draft insider. Going to talk World Juniors, you know, the players whose stock rose, whose stock fell as a result of their performances at the World Junior Hockey Championships. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website with all your latest CBA, Winnipeg Jets, NHL, World Junior. I think I covered everything there. News is www.IllegalCurve.com. You should also head there right now. In about 30 minutes' time, we're going to talk about an article that my colleague Richard Pollock just published, looking ahead at what the Winnipeg Jets' salary cap situation would be next season with the new CBA in place, who's under contract for the Jets, who's not under contract. Go check out that article, illegalcurve.com. We're going to talk about that coming up at the 12:30 p.m. hour. I think, do we have Dennis? All righty, then let's go out to Ufa, Russia, where we're joined by our colleague here on TSN 1290. You heard him and Shane Knighty call the World Juniors. Dennis, good, I guess it's early good morning in Ufa. Good afternoon in Winnipeg.
Well, yeah, it is just past midnight here, and we're all kind of back at the hotel and starting to pack the bags up because the bus for the airport leaves at 4:30. So it'll be a short night, but it'll be good to get on that airplane, and it'll be good to get home.
Absolutely. Obviously, the World Juniors ended earlier this morning with Team USA defeating Team Sweden by a 3-1 margin. Dennis, first question for you. Did the best team win this tournament?
Yes, I think they did. When you looked at a complete team effort, starting from the goaltending on out, I think the U.S. was the best team. It's funny because Seth Jones said before the tournament that he felt they were the best team, and you know, some people thought, okay, there's going to be some bulletin board fodder and things like that. Well, it turns out he was right. They were a very well-balanced team. It's hard to believe that they had to win their last game against Slovakia in the round robin to get to the medal round, because they had trouble scoring goals against Canada and they had trouble scoring goals against Russia in the round robin. But once they got their offense going, this was a very good team, especially in goal with John Gibson and especially on defense. Their defense corps was very impressive.
Dennis, where do you think the blame lies for Canada's lackadaisical performance in the semis against the U.S.?
You know what? That's a real good question. I think that's one that really is bothering the coaches. They're having trouble figuring out exactly what happened. You know, some people said, oh, they shouldn't have given them New Year's Day off. I don't buy that. I mean, players are used to getting days off, and you come back to the rink the next day and you get back to work and away you go. Now, having said that, on the practice on January 2nd, Steve Spott had to bark at the guys a little bit. You know, they really didn't seem like they were fully engaged in the practice. So he did some barking, and then after that, things seemed to be good. They spent a lot of time on the power play. They had some good one-on-one drills, some competitive drills, and everything seemed to be exactly how they wanted to. You know, then the next day rolled around, and it was an afternoon game. They'd played afternoon games the entire time. So their best game was a night game when they played Russia. That was their best game of the round robin. So whether the afternoon played a part, should they maybe have done something differently in the morning, should they have gone in before the dressing room and given Newt Rockne speech, they hadn't done that, and they felt they didn't want to do that game and have the players say, well, why all of a sudden are we getting this Newt Rockne speech? So there's lots of questions, and I think the coaching staff has lots of questions, Hockey Canada always does a debriefing after this, and I think the time from when they finished the Russia game until they started the U.S. game, I think there will be some questions asked and hopefully come up with some answers.
Dennis, in the final two games, Canada gave up 11 goals, and to me it seemed like they were running around in their own end quite a bit, and you could see that there's some defensive deficiencies. Do you think the International Ice Service at all, you know, exposed their, you know, lack of speed and skating ability somewhat in those final two games?
I don't know. You know what? Maybe the defense corps just wasn't as good as we thought it was. When I think back to the summer series, when they played the two games in Yaroslavl and the two games in Halifax, there was a number of different guys on the back end than what the final team looked like. Cody Ceci was there, Pellick was there, and I think what happened, Dumbo was there, I think what happened with Canada guys is I think there was a crop of about 10, 12 defensemen, and they basically were all the same. I think you had Scott Harrington, who was a bit of a shutdown guy, and you had Dougie Hamilton, who was maybe a very good offensive guy, although we never really saw that from him in this tournament. Everybody else was kind of the same and was tough picking the best guys to come to this tournament. And Ryan Murphy, up until in the end when, you know, he kind of got beat in the overtime, him and Morgan Riley both, you know, Ryan Murphy had played very well. So maybe the defense corps as a whole wasn't as good as we thought it was, because some of the passes were ill-advised. Other teams were certainly able to get in on the forecheck. And even Morgan Riley, who is such a great skater, had difficulty in this tournament.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Dennis Bayak. Dennis is in Ufa, Russia, where he called the World Junior Hockey Championships here on TSN Radio, TSN 1290, local station here in Winnipeg, of course. Dennis, who was the best player you saw in this tournament?
Boy, that's a loaded question. There was a number. You know what? That's the one thing that Shane and I talked about, is how good the level of competition was at this turn. One guy that really stood out for me, and we only saw him the one game, was Thomas Hertl, as a San Jose draft pick, and, you know, was very impressive. But there's lots of guys. You look at the U.S. team, and Jacob Trouba, who's a Winnipeg Jet draft pick, I think the Jets people are rubbing their hands with glee, watching him develop and watching him evolve into a top-notch defenseman. He was terrific at this tournament. The U.S. had a couple of other guys. I think Seth Jones, you know what, there's still some hockey to be played, but right now the general consensus is that Seth Jones has solidified himself as the number one guy. We never did see Finland, and that's the one disappointing thing, because we were always at the big rink. We were doing two games a day, and we never got a chance to go over and watch Finland because, as it turned out, they didn't qualify for the medal round. So we never did see the defenseman Barkov, just to watch him live and see how good he was. But if you kind of go over team by team, every team had some guys that were very good players. I think JT Miller, who plays for the U.S. team, is going to be a real solid forward one day in the National Hockey League. May not be a big scorer, but I think he'll be a real solid guy. John Gibson had absolutely a terrific tournament in goal for the U.S. You know, when you look over at Sweden, I think we see a lot of skill in their captain, Forsberg. Lindholm, the kid that's rated very high in the draft this coming summer, showed a lot of skill. So I think you can list a bunch of guys that, you know, that were really impressive. And we never did see all the teams, as it turned out. But the level of play was very, very good.
Dennis, you mentioned Thomas Hertl, from the Czech Republic, San Jose draft pick. You know, moving away from Canada and some of the other players, in 1998, I think every Canadian remembers Brendan Shanahan coming down on Dominik Hasek and Hasek making the brilliant save in the shootout and the Czechs going on to win the gold medal. So that was 14, just about 15 years ago now. Everybody expected the Czechs to kind of take from that and move forward as a hockey nation. Yet you look at their roster in this tournament, they have 13 undrafted players on the roster. What's the reason for the Czechs maybe not building on that momentum of the Olympic victory 15, 14 years ago?
You know what, guys? Something has happened with both the Czech Republic and Slovakia, where they all of a sudden don't seem to be turning out the players that we expect them to. As a result, you talk to some people from those countries, and they're hockey registration is down. They don't have as many players playing as they think they should. I don't know. Is it because a lot of them are leaving and going to play in the Canadian Hockey League, and they don't have everybody coming up on the under-17s and the under-18s together? It shouldn't be a factor because they're getting very good coaching in the Canadian Hockey League, and they all get to come and play at these tournaments, so they still do have all their team play. So it's hard to figure out, but it's a valid point because they have not produced. There was no Slovakians drafted in last summer's draft, and that's hard to understand and hard to explain why. But the Czech Republic, maybe it's the style they play. Everybody talks about how every team in the Czech Republic, whether it's the under-17s, whether it's the under-18s, whether it's the under-20s, play the same way. They're passive. They hang around the middle of the ice. They wait for you to make mistakes. And maybe the true talent level of some of these players isn't being allowed to flourish simply because of the style they play. But those are all just guesses. But it's a concern for some of the people from the Czech Republic.
Dennis, you mentioned earlier that you and Shane didn't have that many chances to watch Finland, but going into the round robin portion of the tournament, a lot was expected of them. You know, they beat Canada obviously in a pre-tournament game, but what was the scuttlebutt as far as why Finland didn't even make the medal round?
Well, it seems, and the name escapes me right now, the youngster that broke his ankle in the first game of the tournament. And apparently he was a very important part of their forward combinations. But still, this team was good enough that they should have been able to get into the medal round. They just couldn't keep the puck out of their own net. They allowed a lot of goals at bad times. They would have a lead, and all of a sudden, bang, bang, they'd give up that lead. And, there will be some question marks. We talk about question marks with Canada and what happened there. There definitely will be some question marks inside the Finnish hockey organization as to what happened, because going into the tournament, many people thought if anybody from that other pool could win the tournament, it was going to be Finland. And I don't think anybody expected the Czech Republic to be as competitive as they were. I don't think anybody expected Switzerland to be as competitive as they were, and yet over the last few years Switzerland has shown that they are becoming a very good hockey nation. But all that aside, Finland still had enough talent that they should have had a lot better showing in this tournament than what they did. So there will be some question marks with regards to that country as well.
The Finnish player who broke his ankle was Miro Aaltonen. He broke it in the first game against Latvia.
There's been too many players and too many teams over the last 12 days to remember all of them, because it's been, we're getting off track a little bit. The game that was probably the most challenging to do is the game that we did on television. It was Slovakia and Germany, and two countries that play a very similar style, have a lot of players that kind of look alike, and it was a challenge to try and keep which players, this number 12 played for this team and this number 12 played for that team. The other ones were always, you had one team that was very easily identified, whether it was Russia, whether it was Sweden, whatever the case was. But that was the one game with those two that we just kind of found it was kind of a rather difficult game to do, let alone the fact it wasn't a very good hockey game.
Dennis, we'll let you go on this last question. You know, when the tournament's in North America, or especially Canada, it's always tremendously well received. I mean, we've seen the arenas packed. How was the tournament received in Russia?
Okay. I don't think great, but I think okay would be probably the best way to put it. When Russia played, the building was very close to full, if it wasn't full. The Canada-Russia game on New Year's Eve, the building was full. The atmosphere when Russia played in the building was terrific. But there were some games earlier in the tournament, Slovakia, United States, even Canada-Slovakia, where there was maybe 1,800, 2,000 people in the building. Now, a lot of the tickets, I think, were sold, and people just didn't bother coming to the rink. But it's not like North America. In North America, you put the packages up for sale, and they're gone. Now, the people from Malmo, Sweden, where the tournament is next year, they had a presentation at the rink this afternoon, and they were going over their ticket pricing, and they were asked the question, the very question you just asked, what do we expect next year in Sweden? And what they've done is they've given a day package for those type of games that don't involve Sweden, they've given a day package. I think it's like $15-$20 Canadian dollars or U.S. dollars for the entire day, and you'll see two games for that price. So they're trying that method. But, you know, I think it was what was expected here. I think that was the end result. I don't think they expected that the games that didn't involve Russia were going to have a full building for. And, I didn't get over to the other rink. The other rink only sat 2,500. I don't think it was ever sold out. So I think as expected when you're not dealing with North American cities.
Dennis, it's been a pleasure hearing you and Shane call these games right across the TSN radio network. Travel safe. Say hi to Shane for us, and hopefully we'll see you back at the arena coming up sometime in the next couple weeks.
Boy, wouldn't that be good news? And that's, I mean, I don't know. There's lots of hockey people here, and 1 hour you talk to somebody, and somebody will tell you, boy, it really sounds good, and then the next hour you'll talk to somebody, and they'll tell you it looks like it's falling off the rails again. So, but I agree. Hopefully we'll all be doing back, getting back to doing what we love to do, and let's hope that they keep pounding those tables in New York and get this thing done. But thanks, and yes, we'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, take this for what it's worth, but at least they're back meeting head to face-to-face. Just in the last couple minutes, they've sat down in the NHLPA hotel face-to-face for face-to-face talks.
Perfect.
There
as
you
long
go.
As they're all in, as long as they're all together in New York, I think that's we can still have our fingers crossed that we're going to have a season that starts about January 19th.
That's what we're hoping for. Dennis, travel safe. Say hi to Shane. We'll see you soon.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Dennis.
Thanks a lot, Dennis.
Dennis Bayak here of TSN Jets, TSN 1290, right across the TSN radio network. You heard him and Shane call the games. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll do our wrap of the World Junior Hockey Championships. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. It's past the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to Dennis Bayak for joining us live from Ufa, Russia. An update from New York City where the negotiations are taking place. I'm going to read a series of tweets here if you guys
are they still locked in the ATM?
Yeah, did somebody order a pizza or eat a muffin?
Lisa Dillman. Lisa's with the LA Times?
Lisa's with the LA Times. It should be noted that Lisa's dad was... they have an award named after Lisa's dad for being like the PR guy, one of the PR people in the NHL. He was very well respected. I believe his name was Dick Dillman.
Yeah. Lisa Dillman, haven't been positive about labor talks in weeks, okay, maybe months. Am now pencil, not ink, for next week's plans. Darren Dreger, well, if it's as close as we're sensing, it could be a very good day, according to a source.
But did Dreger use the Dreger face hashtag?
He didn't. Darren Dreger again, the Players Association Hotel is buzzing in anticipation. Down to minimal issues, but still not done. I think we've heard that before from Darren. And definition of minimal may differ. Adrian Dater, definitely a sense of excitement building about things with the CBA deal. We'll stay on top of it as we're on air here. But and any news that breaks from New York, you'll hear it first here on TSN 1290.
You know, Drew, I think it should be noted that today is Saturday.
Yes.
Today's Saturday the 5th.
Yeah.
They're anticipating the season starting January 19th. You know, there are deadlines that are in place, but just in terms of getting people over from back in Europe or getting people, like, if you're going to have it, you can't have a 4-day training camp.
No.
You just can't do that. I mean, there are new coaches in place. And you know, for example, in Edmonton, you have a new head coach. While he was on the staff last year, he has new ideas and new systems in place. And you can talk about it before the lockout, you know, it was in effect as of September 15th, but you can't do it on the ice. So you can't have people coming in and teaching them a system in 3 days. You have to be able to get something done today or tomorrow, get these people in, get the players in on Tuesday, and then get them ready to go for the following Saturday.
The 19th, you mean?
Yeah.
You're saying, so even if a deal comes out today, and again, this is just pure speculation, if they get something done today, they can't start on the 12th?
No, that's way too soon. I mean, think about it. If you're Evgeny Malkin, you're over...
Isn't that your only incentive for signing a deal today? Is to get an extra week's worth of games, make it a 50-game season or a 52-game season?
I mean, maybe, Drew, and then that's a valid point. But just logistically speaking, I don't know how that happens. I mean, say I'm Evgeny Malkin.
Yeah.
I find out there's a deal this evening.
You have to.
So
you're going to be tough to get back by Monday.
I book a flight Sunday. I get back maybe Monday early in the morning, and I don't know if I'm flying through New York, and then I get to Pittsburgh on Tuesday.
Teams will send.
And then you're starting on Saturday?
Teams will send their charters for these players. But anyways, still a long way before we get to that. We will keep you up to date As things break out of New York City, where a lot of the NHL media are standing around tweeting, which is a step in the right direction, considering that earlier today they were standing around getting their shoes shined, as you can see on various Twitter feeds. So we're at least beyond that stage right now. Let's finish with the World Juniors. Spend the next couple minutes. Finish the World Juniors. Then we're going to talk about your article. Again, you can read that on illegalcurve.com. It sort of forecasts what a Winnipeg Jets team would look like next season with a lower salary cap and how the roster would be assembled at that point. World Juniors, what's your number one takeaway? Do you have a number one takeaway from the tournament?
I was impressed by the United States. I thought they really skated well. I thought their defense was exceptional. Obviously, their goaltending was great. But, if you want to go in the Jets angle, what about Phil Housley, former Jet, coming in?
Yeah. You talk about players always see their stocks rise generally.
Uh-huh.
Phil Housley as a coach probably had his stock rise exponentially.
Absolutely. And you know what? I mean, motivation is a huge thing, and apparently he's motivated the team quite well. But I love the fact that he took a mobile defense with skill.
Uh-huh.
Trouba obviously had a tremendous tournament. Seth Jones, I mean, not even drafted yet.
Yeah.
Great player. And you have a lot of depth on that back end. Mike Riley, guys really come into his own. But the point is he allowed the players to work to their strengths. And it happened to be that that was also his strength. Mobility.
Mobility and
puck movement.
Puck movement, sure.
But I think that team was completely, that team was, as Brian Burke says, built from the backhand out. Mm-hmm. Built from between the pipes and all the way out through the defense. The forwards scored when they had to, although they had a lot of goals from the defense. The forwards weren't even that productive. They didn't have to be. So I think
Rocco Grimaldi, who's a goal scorer, very small, but you would think he'd excel on a big ice surface, given how small he is and how fast he is. Only got his first two goals of the tournament today against Sweden.
Right, and I have to say that was what I took away from the tournament most of all, is that I was very impressed by the play of the Americans. Also, one other thing I want to note, Ezzy, before you get in here, they never let down. The Americans. I mean, sure, they didn't win games and they had trouble scoring, but they never really, there wasn't a letdown. Obviously, Canada had a letdown, and we'll talk about that, but they seemed to be as intense as could be thrown, and I think that's a testament to the players. But I think most of all, I think it's a testament to Housley, because you got to get your players ready, and I think that might have been a problem with Canada, as Dennis alluded to, and as we've read quite a bit online.
Yeah, it's undeniable that Phil Housley did a really good job, and as Dennis said in the interview, they had to beat Slovakia to get to the medal round. Canada beat the U.S. quite easily, in fact. On the 30th of December, the day before New Year's Eve, when they also beat Russia in those back-to-back games. And, they lost to Russia in a shootout. So the U.S. definitely overcame adversity. And, they really did this without a star. Seth Jones, for all of the hype, he didn't dominate at all. And sure, he got he finished with 7 or 8 points or something like that. And he's an immense talent. But there weren't the star-studded power lineup like Canada had. And you look at some of the players that excelled, whether it was against Canada in the semifinals with McCabe on defense getting two goals, or Rocco Grimaldi, who we know plays for UND. And John Gibson, obviously, Richie, as well. John Gibson had the best save percentage of any goaltender since, I believe, Al Montoya. That's what TSN said during the
Winnipeg Jets goaltender, Al Montoya.
Absolutely. So, the U.S. peaked at the right time. I still think that, overall, Canada was the best team in this tournament. And I was telling Richie off air, I watched the game this morning. Canada could have
PVR'd the game. You didn't get up at 3:30 in the morning.
Well, I PVR'd the game, but I watched it this morning.
Yeah, I know. I'm bugging you.
And I actually did stay up for a couple of the games. But, Canada, for everyone's going to look back at this tournament, and, it's the first time Canada hasn't won a medal in, a decade and a half. But they still played well, and you have to look at a guy like Mark Scheifele. He got 5 goals in the tournament. He played really well today. He could have, in fact, gotten the winning goal today. He hit the post in the third period. Canada has nothing to be ashamed of. They didn't play well in the key games. They gave up 2 goals early against the Russians today, and they were generally lackadaisical, as Richie mentioned earlier. That's a good word, in the game against the USA. They didn't play well in the two games that mattered most.
If you look back in Canada's 2 Olympic wins, okay, just to analogize it to the Olympic wins, 2002 and 2010. How did Canada play throughout the round robin in both those tournaments?
They struggled.
Both, interestingly, and they turned it up. And it kind of was the opposite here.
Yep.
Canada was peaked at the wrong time.
Well, the NFL playoffs start today, and you always hear about these teams that get hot leading into the playoffs and then going on their run. The New York Giants, of course, last couple of years. But it's true. You don't want to peak you know, in your final round robin game, especially if your talent level is not so, leaps and bounds ahead of whoever your opponents are going to be in the round robin. If you don't bring your A game against Russia and the United States, you're going
to
lose.
And one more thing, Drew, before we go to break.
Yeah.
You know, Canada had to play a game in the Olympics 2010 before they played Russia. And so they played it back-to-back. But, you know, people talk about James Duffy mentioned it on TSN on the post-game broadcast. Maybe that not playing. Maybe keeping your legs fresh. I mean, these are kids. One thing you have to understand when you're playing games fairly close together, if you're not traveling, these guys are used to skating all the time.
Sure.
So maybe that layoff was an issue. I don't know. But I do think that motivation was an issue. I don't think the Canadian coaching staff, I think they overthought it a bit. I kind of analogize it to John Farrell in Toronto with the Blue Jays, a baseball analogy, in that, you know, it seemed like everything was going all right, and they looked the part, but there was a lack of motivation, I thought, in that game, and that's a game that you have to get the guys up for.
Sort of, you can't treat every game at this sort of
that's right.
energy.
That's
not
exactly
every game
right.
is the same. You that's have to put an
exactly
emphasis
right.
on some games.
You have to.
In the game against the U.S., I was kind of talking about this after the game with someone. I almost felt like it was less so the U.S. playing well against Canada and more so the Canadian team just not playing well. I mean, they turned over the puck so much, weren't finishing their checks. Simple things that any Canadian junior team does. And I was just going to quickly say, Drew, in the last 4 years, they've won two silvers, a bronze, and a fourth-place finish. But they've only lost two or three games during the regulation the round-robin portion. So that shows you that they have been good teams that just haven't been able to finish it at during crunch time.
The talent gap is not such anymore that you can coast. If you don't bring your A game, especially against the Russians and the Americans, you're going to lose.
Let's be honest here. Let's call a spade a spade. That was a choke job.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to give these guys, and I know they're young kids, sure, but they're going to get all the credit in the world if they win, which they've gotten for many years. Then you have to criticize them. The performance was poor, and it wasn't just one guy. It wasn't like the goaltending. The performance was poor all around, and that falls on the shoulders of the players, forwards, defensemen, and the coaching staff.
It's not like the Americans played that much better in the semifinal game than the than they had in the round-robin game against the Canadians. The Canadians just played that much worse. So, I mean, not taking away the credit from the Americans, but you're going to play any team in this tournament, and if you're not going to play your A game, you're just not going to win. Before we go to break, quickly, Kevin Paul DuPont of the Boston Globe. Keep hearing / reading sense of energy and optimism around today's CBA talks in New York City. An agent says, teams are gearing up. Feels like it will be a go. You'll hear it first on TSN 1290. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment of the program is brought to you by David Carr of Monopoly Realty. Buying and selling a house is one of the most important and stressful life experiences. It's not an experience to be undertaken by yourself or left in the hands of a rank amateur. David Carr of Monopoly Realty takes the stress out of your real estate experience while you are secure in the knowledge that a true real estate professional is looking after your transaction. David Carr of Monopoly Realty can be reached at 230-6129. One more time, that's David Carr of Monopoly Realty for all your real estate needs, 230-6129. Richie, you published an article earlier today on illegalcurve.com, sort of with the subject being what the Winnipeg Jets might look like in 2013-14 with a $60 million salary cap. I'm going to spend the next 25 minutes or so going over that article. To start with, let's talk about the players that are have a contract with the Winnipeg Jets for 2013-2014. There's five forwards.
Mm-hmm.
Evander Kane making the most at $5.25 million. Olli Jokinen is under contract at $4.5 million. Andrew Ladd at $4.4 million. Jim Slater at $1.6 million. And then Chris Thorburn at $860,000. The defensemen, there's three of them under contract. Bufflin at $5.2 million. Enstrom at $5.75 million and Mark Stewart at $1.7 million and goaltender Andre Pavlik at $3.9 million. So what you have there is you have 9 players at $33.16 million that are under contract for 2013-2014. So you at that point in time have about 20. Sorry,
I have the numbers here, Drew. So
go
I mean,
ahead.
It's what you do is you have 9 players under contract for the 2013-2014 season.
Yeah.
if you presume that they're going to be carrying 14 forwards, 7 defensemen, 2 goalies, being a 23-man roster,
right?
Unless the CBA is amended, and it's possible because they're currently in the midst of negotiations.
Sure. Maybe there's more roster spots or whatever.
Yeah, likely not.
We haven't heard any talk about that.
The only way there'd be more roster spots, in my opinion, would be if they shut down Phoenix, and I don't think that's going to suddenly happen in this period of time.
That would change. That would be a story to talk about.
That's right. So consequently, the Jets have 14 roster spots to fill.
That's right.
And with that, they have $26.84 million. That's mm-hmm. simply taking $60 million cap
yeah.
and taking off the $33 million that they have invested in those 9 players you mentioned.
That's right.
So $26 million yeah. for 14 spots is $1.91 million per roster spot.
That's correct.
So that's how much you have allotted on an average to spend on the players you're pulling in. So, but people need to understand, lots has been said about there's $60 million cap, which is, by the way, is hypothetical. NHL wants 60. The NHLPA apparently has dropped their demands from 67.5 to 65. Will they meet in the middle? It's possible. NHL is apparently very adamant about the 60. Who knows what will happen?
Right.
It's give and take on, obviously, every negotiation. Certainly this one.
plenty of that.
But people understand, there's teams like Montreal, whatever, they have a lot of contracts on the books, and they have to make a lot of adjustments. But people have to understand, the Jets may not have a lot of contracts on the books, but they still have some restricted free agents on the roster.
Key restricted free agents.
Who are gonna ask for and probably sign for a fair amount of money.
That's correct. Let's talk about those restricted free agents. There's really 4 of them that jump to mind. The first one is Brian Little will be an RFA. We know he's been the second, third line center. On a good team, that's where he'd be. On the Jets, he's been first, second line center.
Yeah, he's been like a first line center for the most part in the Jets, and I have him as more of a bottom half of a second line center in the National Hockey League.
Right.
Of course, Ole Oken signing pushes him down, in my opinion, to second line center.
Right. So let's talk about, we've spoken before. Previously, you wrote an article about what you think Brian Little would be worth. What he should sign for when he's a restricted free agent. So let's start with him in terms of what you could foresee his salary demands being.
Well, you have to take into account the fact that
currently he's making $2.38 million.
Right. And so these things change all the time, right, Drew? The question is is he what I'm asking in the article I wrote about him before is he a second line center? And so if you're taking certain players in mind. A guy like an Antoine Vermette's more of a two-way guy. Sam Gagne, a right-handed shooting, younger player with some talent. Or Tim Connolly, same kind of idea. Different players.
Yeah.
Gagne's more of a hands guy. Connolly's more of a passer. Little's more of a shooter. But you're looking at the $3.25 to $4.25 million range. And so I took an average there and I just said, 3.75 seems like about what he would make on the next contract. Whether or not the Jets give it to him, I think, is a different story. But we're going to assume that they're going to have him here for this analysis.
That's right. The other player that is another player who's a restricted free agent in the 2013-2014 season, coming off a big year mm-hmm. for the Winnipeg Jets, Zach Bogosian. We had just, prior to last year, he signed the 2-year sort of bridge contract. He's got 1 year of RFA status left, and then he'll become a UFA. Based on his performance last season, and a lot of the stuff you hear and read about him enjoying his time in Winnipeg, you'd expect that he's going to be a priority for Kevin Cheveldayoff to try and re-sign for a relatively long period of time, buy out some of those UFA years that he's rapidly approaching.
Exactly. As you mentioned, Drew, this will be a 6th season. He'll have 5 seasons, so he'll have 2 more years until he's a UFA.
Right.
And that is, seven accrued seasons is how it works, right? That's not going to change under the current negotiations as far as we've learned.
Right.
A guy like Bogosian, who can skate like the wind, who can hit, who can basically do everything you want him to do for the most part, maybe a tad limited offensively, but aside from that, a guy like that's somebody you want in the stable for the long haul. So we put him at a number at $5 million
mm-hmm.
on an average of, I don't know how long the deal would be. That's just an approximate figure. A guy like Buffon signed for 5.2. A guy like Buffon adds a ton of offense. It was signed by previous management in terms of Rick Dudley. And then you look
Atlanta
at...
Atlanta management.
Right. And then you look at Tobias Enstrom, older guy, pending UFA, yeah. So different contract negotiation.
Had a little bit more leverage.
More leverage. So a guy like Bogosian, something around the neighborhood of $5 million seems appropriate in circumstances.
Do you think Enstrom is worth more than Bogosian?
Different situations, as we just mentioned.
Right.
It's largely
a result of the situation, you think?
And Enstrom adds such an offensive element that Bogosian doesn't have as much offensive skill as Enstrom. That's just
and just facts. To get in here quickly too, Richie, on the topic of Bogo versus Enstrom, it's difficult, for people to maybe understand this, but Bogo's still very young. He's a very good defenseman for his age. And you know, defensemen really don't peak at this young in their career. I mean, it's scary to think a guy like Drew Doughty is also the same age as Bogosian. And, you know, he hasn't peaked yet. But Tobias Enstrom got the contract, and we talked about it when Chevy signed him. And, you know, it was long-term, and, you know, he might have got a little bit more. But Enstrom offers, like you said, those offensive capabilities. But, again, I look, you know, I know you want to continue here, guys, but I look at Bogosian, and to me, him along with Wheeler are keys here. And when you think about Brian Little, he's the guy to me that – Are they going to try to sign him long-term as well? Blake Wheeler proved last year by leading the Jets in scoring. He deserves to get a long-term contract, but are you going to be able to fit all those guys under long-term contracts?
It's a good question. I think Little also. I mean, is Little your second-line center? You know, you have Jokinen for that 1 year after this. Is Scheifele then taking the second-line center role, or are you going to move him more slowly? Or are you going to move Little, or Scheifele, I don't think Scheifele moved to the wing. You can move Little to the wing, or do you trade him? So there's many options.
That's right. But we're speculating that we expect Zach Bogosian, if he re-signs with the Winnipeg Jets, we're going with the assumption, and give or take a little bit here, about a $5 million average annual value.
I think that's
a contract.
Pretty good number, to be honest with you.
For the Jets, you mean, or for in terms of...
What Richie has Bogo at $5 million, I think, is right around where he'll end up getting. I mean, the sky's the limit for him. He's 22 years old. I mean, so $5 million is a good number for him there.
Next player the Jets need to re-sign, if they so choose, of course. He'll be an RFA in 2013-2014. Blake Wheeler. Really came into his own as a Winnipeg Jet last year, made some great strides forward. He looks like he's the Jets, right winger, probably first. He's been their first line right winger, might be their second line right winger, depending on how good the team gets. How do you anticipate the Jets paying Blake Wheeler?
Well, Blake Wheeler's an interesting one, Drew, in that he's really come into his own. Mm-hmm. He is a guy who spent a lot of time in the NCAA in Minnesota, and then obviously got out of Phoenix where he was drafted and moved over to Boston. He really came into his own at the end of he had one good season in Boston, struggled a bit, and then he was traded to Atlanta at the end of the previous season, the season before last. And he really gelled with, Ladd a little bit. And then he came into this year, struggled at times scoring-wise, but showed a great sense of great skating ability. Not the most natural scorer, but a great passer, can carry the puck, can do a lot of things. I think what I read in the article is the thing the Jets need to ask, is he a first-line right winger or is he a second-line right winger? But in any event, I think they sign him.
Right.
And he seems to like it here as well. He's been only saying positive things about the city of Winnipeg. So when you take that into account, a guy like Blake Wheeler, to me, checks in somewhere around the same kind of money as a guy like Andrew Ladd. They're going to be in similar situations.
Right.
Both after the season, Blake Wheeler's got one more season as an RFA.
And he'll be a UFA after. He's got 1 year of RFA eligibility in 2013-2014. Then he could become a UFA if he so chose to go down that road.
Exactly. So, I put him at a number similar to Andrew Ladd, $4.5 million, Yeah, it's the same kind of questions you asked with Andrew Ladd. I think he's a second-line left winger. A good one.
Right.
But the question is then, is he a first or second? Wheeler kind of have the same questions at times. There's some consistency issues. You pay him about the same.
Right. Fair enough. So you got 4.5 down on the books for Blake Wheeler. Last RFA, a guy probably
significant
RFA, of course. Probably the most interesting of all of them is Alex Burmistrov. He was rushed into the NHL. We saw he struggled at times last year. Wasn't as great. He's down playing in St. John's, although he's been injured as of recently. How did the Jets handle Alex Burmistrov?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if he's in the future plans. I don't know. I have my skepticism about that. He may be on his way out. I don't know. But if he does sign, and I think this year, he's had some injury issues. If he signs, and I don't see him tearing it up this year, if he plays, where does he fit in terms of offensively? Maybe they put him on a line with Ponikarovsky and Andropov and try and let them all go. I don't see him tearing it up, though, especially coming off of an injury. So I see him kind of re-signing, and this obviously can go both ways, but I see a guy like him, Burmistrov, re-signing, maybe a one-year deal. The Jets want to see, we don't want to lock you up for 2 years. We don't want you getting too comfortable. We'll give you 1 year. Basically what you made the year before at about $1.5 million. We'll see what you got.
Because he hasn't done anything, with no disrespect, he hasn't done anything to really indicate that he deserves a raise over the $1.5 million he's been making during his entry-level deal.
Absolutely. Well, Drew, at this point, all Burmistrov has shown in the NHL is that he has flashes of being a future NHLer. At this point, he's still a guy that is very much trying to find his game. I mean, Burmy, at many points in the game, you you wonder, is he going to do a, is he going to perform a checking role, or is he going to, you know, is he going to go out there and do something on the power play? Last year, he went through very many goal scoring droughts. Right now, it's tough. I'd have to agree with Richie. At this point, you have to think he's going to get a couple of years. He's definitely not in a category of getting a long-term deal, because there's just too many question marks. And, you know, we were talking about this a little bit off air, but Burmistrov and Little would probably be the best trade candidates for the Jets, based on the fact that you don't really know, are they even going to be able to perform a second-line role for your team?
And just before you go to break, I mentioned Burmistrov, you know, the 1.5 about. Under the former CBA, if I recall correctly, you have to tender a qualifying offer to Burmistrov, which has to be at least a 10% increase over the season pass because of the amount of money he's making.
Right.
But the 1.5 is including, I believe, reaching entry-level bonuses. So I believe that the 10% kicker wouldn't necessarily be fully in place, because I don't know the specific bonuses that are in place.
So right now we have, for 2013-2014, 8 forwards on the roster, including all these RFAs, 4 defensemen and 1 goaltender. That leaves the team 10 roster spots to fill, with cap space remaining of $12.09 million. When we come back, we'll talk about how they're going to fill those last 10 spots. A brief update from New York. This is according to Nick Kyprios' source. Tentative deal could be done within 24 hours, or the NHLPA could serve the NHL notice to disclaim as early as today. The present meeting, undoubtedly, is quite huge. You'll hear it first on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Shortly before the top of the hour here on TSN 1290, we're talking about what the Winnipeg Jets roster would look like in 2013-2014 with a $60 million salary cap and various players re-signed that are restricted free agents. Jets have 10 roster spots to fill based on our estimation. They have $12.1 million in cap room to round things out. At this point in time, you're pretty much looking at depth players for the most part.
Well, depth players and young players, Drew, and you need your young players to be better than depth players, I think, is the most important thing. But isn't it interesting, just guys going back to last segment, isn't it interesting how quickly the money goes?
Yeah, it doesn't take long, especially at a salary cap of $60 million.
It doesn't
really leave you a lot of options in free agency.
And the Jets are one of the, well, that's exactly it. We're going to get to that, but the Jets are one of the more teams with more flexibility. Imagine being some of the other teams.
Yeah,
granted,
certainly.
Talent always wins out.
And, of course, those will be the teams that have that'll be our offseason. That'll be our offseason, is figuring out how these teams are going to, you know, work around, get under the salary cap with everything else and their buyouts and everything. We'll get audio from that coming up in a little bit. Darren Dreger speaking on TSN right now, I guess doing an update as to the negotiations in New York, as we'll keep you updated as well. So we haven't really mentioned a lot of the young guys for the Jets.
Yeah.
Mark Scheifele being the primary one.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you've seen him in this tournament, and they clearly need him to be a mover and shaker.
The Jets have 3 forward spots they have to fill with young guys. They have defensive spot to fill with a young guy.
The lifeblood of an organization like the Jets is young talent outperforming their contracts, meaning
right.
Providing more value. The classic catch term around everywhere is value. So you're looking at what we talked about before. You have eight forwards, and so you need to fill those. You know, you need to fill with 5 more forwards. So you need to have a few young players who can come in and really perform.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at Scheifele.
Yeah.
Whether he plays center, whether he plays wing. I don't think, by the way, he comes in this year. I really don't think he comes in this year. Maybe I'm wrong. They got enough forwards on the roster. He's not a difference maker.
You're right, because we haven't even talked about guys that are going to be off the books. Guys like Ponikarovsky and Antropov. You know, guys
Wellwood.
Like Wellwood.
Hainsey.
Hainsey's on the
defenseman
defensive
side.
But you're right. They don't have an overwhelming incentive for this year, assuming there is one, to rush Scheifele up. They can leave him in the OHL for another year and just make the transition next year.
And let me ask you one thing quickly before we get back to what we're talking about. If you're trying to aid a player's development,
mm-hmm.
He's already played half the season in junior.
Yeah.
If you're going to use a contract year and
you're going to burn a contract year,
why would you burn it on half the season?
Well, Richie, this
you
is
probably
also another...
wouldn't, but hang on. Here's a tweet from Gary regarding Mike Scheifele. I believe he just says, when the CBA is signed, if the CBA is signed, and the GMs are given new instructions on the rules, Jets will recall Mark Scheifele at least for training camp.
Yeah. Oh, and I understand that.
Yeah. Gary just tweeted that. Gary Laws.
You want him playing against NHL players when it doesn't cost you a year.
Of course.
But don't bring him up for a year, in my opinion. Don't bring him up for a year if you're going to burn a contract year for half a season when in reality he's not going to make the difference between a cup or a playoff spot even, really, to me.
This is the difference, and I think, Richie, you'll see where I'm going with this. This is different than Tyler Seguin in Boston the year that they won the Cup. You know that you have a good team. You know you have a good chance at making the Stanley Cup. You know that Seguin can come in and play a role on your third line, but also is good enough to play on your second line. I would have to agree with you. I'm the biggest fan of Mark Scheifele that there is out there. But, you know, Mark Scheifele, again, this is where I think it's going to be interesting for the Jets in the 2013-2014 season and the season after. It's that they've got Jokinen next year, sure. And, you know, you could argue that he's the first-line center this year in a half-season situation. But then moving forward, you're going to have Scheifele, who's probably going to play a third-line role, maybe a second-line role, but not right when he comes in. It's very rare where you have a 19-year-old kid coming in and that's you're right. asking him to play a second-line center role. So moving forward, I think you're going to have a situation where, okay, do you sign Little for $3.5, $4 million, like you said, Richie, maybe $3.75, like you wrote in your article, or do you maybe try to trade Little and get, you know, that first-line center, which basically that's what you need to be successful in the NHL moving forward, and that's what the Jets need the most. They have their number one goaltender. They have a pretty solid defense, in my opinion. That's their strengths. You really that's the role you're going to have to fill eventually, is your number one line center, because you know Kane is your left winger, and you know Wheeler can play already on the top line right wing. So are you going to maybe use that extra money to go after a top line center?
It's asset management, and let me just say this, Drew. Brian Little will get you more in a trade than Olli Jokinen will.
Of course.
If you don't think Brian Little is going to be your first-line center, or maybe not a great second-line center, if you want to build a cup team, then you can get more for Brian Little than you can for Jokinen. And Jokinen can probably still outperform Little when they're paired up against each other.
Agreed, wholeheartedly there. We have Scheifele as getting one of the final three roster spots up front. So we have two empty roster spots to fill.
Well, there's a couple more still. There's going to be 13 players on the roster, forwards on the roster. Doesn't mean that they all play. You have eight, as we're talking about.
Right. Yeah, so. I miscounted there. You're right. So we have a couple guys, you know, a couple other guys down in the minors who can jump up into play roles that we've seen.
And I'm picking young guys. It could be different young guys. Pick Jason Gregoire. I mean, the guy can skate. He seems responsible. He's in control. Yeah. He can toss in a little offense. I mean, if Kanner Glass is playing left wing for the team on the fourth line last year, there's no reason why a guy like Jason Gregoire can't make the step. Not this year, but next year, as a guy on the fourth line left wing kind of spot. It's not concrete. Just a suggestion.
That's right. You took Jason Gregoire, but you could have just as easily taken, you know, Carl Klingberg or sure. any of those other young guys sure. that are down right. in St. John's. And we're assuming that they don't, you know, that they're not planning on re-signing any of their UFAs, guys like Antti Miettinen or Kyle Wellwood. And this organization does seem to have an affinity for a guy like Kyle Wellwood.
I can see Wellwood because of his flexibility. Can play power play, can play center, can play right wing. I don't see Antropov and Ponikarovsky and Miettinen coming back after this year.
A lot would depend on, Richie, how Ponikarovsky plays, but I think out of Ponikarovsky, Antropov, and Wellwood, I would agree with you that Wellwood, I mean, I know we're going to get a little off topic here, but Kyle Wellwood had his best year. You can't say enough about what he did, you know, after nobody signed him. So I think, you know, rightly so, True North and the Jets should have a bit of an affinity for Wellwood. The fans loved him. But at the end of the day, Wellwood on this team is going to fill a third and fourth line role, Drew, because you know that the Jets are going to sign other guys and expect those guys to be their top six forwards. Nobody's expecting Kyle Wellwood next year in a full season to do what he did last year, which was play a top six role.
Well, and he shouldn't. I mean, he shouldn't if the team is really good.
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to.
You okay?
I'm okay. But it's amazing. I mean, the point of this article is to show how easily, just by sort of keeping your own players under contract, you're bumping up against the salary cap there.
And it ends up being that you have, at the end of the day, you have 11 forwards, 5 defensemen, and a goalie signed. You have 6 roster spots left to fill with only $8 million left. And that's assuming the Jets go up to the ceiling of the cap, which they haven't demonstrated necessarily that they will. So if they add on the remaining spots at 6, basically minimum level players, yeah. minimum wage players in the NHL speaking, obviously,
right.
you're looking at about $56 million, which is probably going to be in the upper 15 or 20. And they're already spending quite a bit. And if they want to splurge in quote-unquote on a free agent, they're not going to really have enough to go get a big free agent, I don't think, from another team, if there are any available. And it hasn't really been their MO. So it looks like, I mean, your team is going to be, unless you make trades, and obviously you have draft picks moving up, the money's kind of gone quickly. And that's so people right. have to realize that. So I think it's interesting. And I guess quickly, Drew, Myrtle at the top of the hour, buyouts. I don't see the Jets really. Every contract on this books coming into the 2014 season will have been signed by Kevin Cheveldayoff, except Save it except for Dustin Byfuglien, Mark Stewart, and Thorburn. He's not buying out Byfuglien because he's one of their best defensemen. Stewart's a good guy in the room, block shots. They need a guy like
and
him.
And he'd be on his last year of his contract
and
at that point.
And then Thorburn, I mean, if you're buying him out, well, you're paying money to then replace him. So you're actually paying more money out of the pocket for Chipman and Thompson. And, you know, what are you replacing him with? And if he can be a happy-go-lucky 13th guy, maybe you keep a guy like that. So it's possible, but not. I don't think it's probable.
It's unlikely. And if he ever was to buy out one of the own guys he signed, it would be a flashing light of a demonstration of a bad signing. So it's unlikely it's going to happen. We'll talk more about this. If there's an NHL season, we know we'll really talk a lot more about this. Let's go to break. When we come back, James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail is going to be joining us in a moment. Richard, a question came in on Twitter. Somebody asked about Paul Postma. You have Zach Redmond ahead of Paul Postma in the article you just published. A quick clarification.
Well, last week on the show, we had Robin Short on from the St. John's Telegram, and he advised us and his belief that Zach Redmond had passed Paul Postma on the depth chart, was playing far better than him, and would be the first recall or at camp if camp starts. So that's why we don't have Postman there as opposed to Redmond. That doesn't mean Postman wouldn't be the guy below him in terms of filling out the roster. But Redmond, as far as Robin Short's concerned, he's seen him play a heck of a lot more than any of us. He's ahead of him.
There you go.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the Globe and Mail. He's our good friend, James Myrtle. James, good afternoon. How you doing?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Our pleasure, James. You wrote a couple very interesting articles earlier this week. The first one was about variance as it relates to the collective bargaining agreement. And then the second one you wrote about yesterday was about escrow. We'll start with the variance article first. Before we get into the nitty-gritty details of variance, can you sort of give our listeners an overview about what variance means vis-a-vis NHL contracts?
Well, I mean, the simplest way to talk about it is to think of it as the amount that a contract varies year to year. And, you know, we've seen with deals like the Kovalchuk one where, you know, it was shifting three, four, you know, at some points in the Kovalchuk one, it's shifting $5 or $5.5 million a season. And what variance would do is it would get rid of those drops. It would get rid of the drops where guys are making $7 million 1 year and then 2 or 3 years later they're making $1 million or $500,000. And, you know, the NHL is trying to get rid of the backdiving contracts that have been talked about so much.
James, can you talk about the difference, and you wrote about it on the Globe and Mail, about the difference between, say, a 10% variance and a 30% variance?
Well, it gets kind of complicated, and then that's sort of, I mean, I wrote like 1,000 words or 1,100 words on it. I mean, that's how complicated it is to explain all the different proposals that are out there. I mean, basically 10%, if you're making $10 million in the first year of a contract, the most that the variance can be, the most that the contract can vary year to year is $1 million. So you can go down to $9 million, you can go up to $11 million, and each year further on you can move another $1 million every season. 10% variance is pretty strict. I mean, the most of a backdiving contract you could have is probably something that went 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4 over 7 years. And that would solve a lot of the problems. But, you know, what's being talked about now, the NHL's proposed 30% variance, but there would be a limit where you could only go down to the lowest you could go is 60% of the contract. So if it's a $10 million salary, you can only go down to $6 million at the very lowest. So that's the basics of what they're talking about right now with variance.
James, we know that whenever the CBA is signed, there will be contract term limits, most likely 6 years or 7 years. Obviously, for your own players, you'll be able to sign your own players to a longer-term deal. But from an objective perspective, how necessary is the variance going to be that we're talking about here when we know that there's already going to be contract term limits?
I think that's the misconception, that it's not that important. I mean, I think it's actually very important to have some kind of a variance limit. Because even if you even look at some of the 7-year deals out there or the 8-year deals out there, you do get into variance problems, you know. And I think the best example of it is Chris Pronger's contract. And now, you know, Chris Pronger's hurt. He's probably never going to play again in the NHL. But let's assume that he was going to play the next 4 years. I mean, the deal that he has is paying him $7.5 million the first couple of seasons. And the last two seasons, it's only paying him basically the league minimum salary. So I mean, that's an extreme variance, and what it's designed to do is take a player who was 35 years old when he signed the deal, is not going to play at age 41 and 42, and the only reason that the last 2 or 3 years of the contract exist is just to bring the cap hit down. And it, without variance, that would very much still be possible. You could still give a 35-year-old player that kind of contract, and I think that would happen over and over and over again if there wasn't a variance limit.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail. James, is there need for a variance rule if there's also a rule enacted that at no point in time can a contract dip below X percent of the highest yearly salary of the contract?
No, probably not. I mean, depending on how high that minimum is, and that's the thing. I mean, the NHL is talking about a 60% minimum. Well, if there's a 60% minimum, I mean, let's say you're making $5 million a year, 60% minimum is $3 million. I mean, if you can't go lower than $3 million, then what's the big deal, right? I mean, you can vary all you want if you're not going to be able to go there. I mean, the only thing with that is that if there's no variance, you could get into a situation where it varies upwards and then comes down. So let's say you didn't have a variance, so you could start at $5 million and it could go up. I mean, there are maybe ways around that, but I think you're right. I mean, if there's a 60% minimum that you can only go down to, it probably doesn't matter what amount it can move year to year.
You know, it seems like the general managers and these teams always will find a way to circumvent, you know, the CBA to the best of their advantage. That's what we saw. That's why we're even talking about variance, is they worked around, you know, the rules in the previous CBA. You know, do you anticipate the NHL putting any wording into the CBA to sort of, you know, almost like a good faith clause in terms of negotiating the variance in salaries so that the general managers can't, you know, parse language in order to work around it?
I doubt it. No, I mean, that's sort of the GM's job a little bit, is to find the advantages they can get. And that's why the NHL has been so, I guess, strict, you could say, in what they're proposing, is they really want to get rid of those deals.
James, talk about escrow, and you wrote a great article about this on the Globe and Mail and globesports.com. I guess in basic terms, you know, a lower cap means lower escrow, and a higher cap means higher escrow. But can you explain to the listeners, you know, how that can cause some infighting?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, a higher cap is obviously better for players that need a contract, right? I mean, if the players want a $65 million cap, then that's going to open up room for guys like Ryan Getzlaff and Corey Perry that need deals. And if you have a lower cap, obviously those guys are going to have a harder time getting higher salaries. They're going to have few options for places they can go and play. But if you're a player that doesn't need a contract, it's a lower cap is better for you as an individual, because the higher cap is going to create more escrow. It's going to create more is going to be spent on salaries, and more of a bite is going to come out of a larger percentage of the membership. So there's a debate there, and what they've settled on is that they're willing to take the higher escrow because it sort of spreads the pain among all NHL players.
James, you know, you're talking about that pain, and this is the same piece that you wrote, but why is that escrow pain really only going to be temporary?
The easy answer to that is because revenues presumably are going to rise in the NHL over time. You know, you look at over the last agreement, the last CBA, 7-8 years, revenues basically went up about 6 or 7% a season on average. If that happens, the escrow pain is only going to last one season. But if that doesn't happen, then maybe not. You know, maybe escrow is a problem for a long time. And what's happening here is they're trying to transition from the players getting 57% down to 50%. And that's a big transition. I mean, that's a pretty big number, and it's pretty significant. And that's why escrow needs to come in here and sort of ease that transition for the teams, but also make it really tough on the players. But it is going to be temporary, because in theory, the league is going to start growing again once it gets back to playing.
In theory. Last question here, James. You know, we've heard a lot about make whole and the $300 million that the NHL is going to be paying the NHLPA for that. Do we know yet how the $300 million is going to be split up among the players?
No, I mean, we saw what it was proposed previously. You know, the previous proposal had $250 million with the bulk of it was in the first season, and then there was a lot in the second season, and then basically nothing after that. I mean, most of the money is going to go in the first year. Then there's going to be a large share in the second year. But, I mean, none of that's official right now. And the thing is that the shorter of a season that they end up playing, the less money that they're going to need and make whole in the first year. So, you know, that's going to be a debate, I think, there between the NHL and the PA, how that money is split up and when it comes out. But expect most of it to be in the first couple of years.
James, is that money just going to be divided evenly between all the players?
You know, that's a good question. It's supposed to go to existing contracts, so it could just be the guys that have deals now that are paid out on that money.
James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail, we appreciate the insight as always. James, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Hopefully we'll get back to some real hockey in the next couple of weeks.
I think we will. I think it's another week or 10 days and we're there.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Thanks very much, James.
Yep.
Take care. James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail joining us here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. News from New York is sort of the same as it was before. Sounds like they're getting close. If it happens, you'll hear it first on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, but hopefully that'll be good news, hopefully. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail for having joined us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. You can also download the show off the TSN 1290 website, tsn1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website with the latest NHL, CBA, Winnipeg Jets, whatever else you want. That's IllegalCurve.com. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joining
the
studio.
By the way, that whatever else you want would include the Beard Progress.
Yes, the Beard Progress, of course.
Yeah.
In case you're just joining us on that, Ezzy and I are growing beards for the Heart and Stroke Foundation in conjunction with Festival de Voyageur. So if you go to the Friday morning papers, every Friday you'll see an update on how our progress is with the beard growing.
I have to say, you both look pretty good with beards.
See, I've done the beard before, but I think this is new for Drew.
It's the first time I've ever had a beard of this nature, yes.
Yeah, and people are, you know, coming up to Drew downtown and calling him Grizzly Adams. And, you know, Drew's a little bit taken aback, but a beard's nothing new for me, but it looks good on you, Drew, I have to say, and maybe you'll be keeping it. I don't know, but
we'll see. Anyways.
It's tight.
You can see it. You can check out our progress on IllegalCurve.com. Gentlemen, the CBA, we're at least into the, at the very least, we know that this is almost over. You know, come, you know, maybe today, maybe a week from today, maybe 2 weeks from today. We know for sure that we're either going to have an NHL season or we're going to become a lacrosse show. I'm not sure what we're going to become at that point in time.
I don't want to think about it, Drew.
We'll never become a lacrosse show. Maybe a lawn bowling show, but never a lacrosse show. But no, you're right, Drew. We're going to know probably by Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I mean, there isn't an exact date. Obviously, the NHL said January 11th. I think that's actually a little bit late. I think it's going to be more like January 9th.
Well, let's talk about let me ask you guys, we know when the season needs to start by, but, you know, when the season needs to start by and the date that the CBA is signed are two very different dates.
Right.
Today's the 5th of January.
Yeah.
The season has to start by 2 weeks from today, the 19th of January. Do we think, if there's no deal by next Saturday?
Next Saturday? Yeah, that's done. See you later.
Well, so when's the deadline? What day?
Well,
what day next week is the deadline?
What our colleague Gary Lawless said was next Thursday.
Well,
and I have no reason to believe that that's not the case, because Gary's a credible journalist. So I would have to agree.
Thanks
and
for
I'm going to take that just like as Gary would say, I'm a credible broadcaster and just a generally fantastic person.
Yes,
but. No, I mean,
in fact, you know, as good as Dragerface on Twitter was this week, Gary crowdsourcing earlier to see whether or not he should block Ezzy was even better on Twitter. You can go through their timelines and see if you want to find that.
I'm glad that Gary didn't block me because I get a lot of my news from him. But, you know, it's next Thursday, next Friday, whatever. But yeah, Saturday, Richie is way too late. If they don't have a deal, we were talking about this off air. I almost think like if there's going to be a deal, it's going to be Monday, Tuesday.
Yeah, I think a deal will probably get done by tomorrow, I'd say. That's what I'd guess.
Or even tomorrow.
It's because in terms of, logistics here. You get it done tomorrow. I was saying before, you get guys in on Wednesday, Thursday. They have to pack up their stuff. They're not sitting at the airport with their luggage watching TV. They have families. They have people they're with their wives or with their kids, whatever it may be. Some are stationed here, obviously, or in any other city. By the time they get here, gives them about a 10-day training camp. Guys, a 10-day training camp is not very long.
No, it's usually 3.5 weeks.
And that takes into account also 10-day training camp really doesn't not even that long because if you're playing on the road, you're leaving a day or two before and
10 days, Richie. 10 days is nothing.
Absolutely.
I mean, if they wait till January 10th or 11th, that's cutting it very close. And they're thinking about that. I mean, the pressure is on right now, and that's why they met for whatever 20 hours or whatever this week, and they're meeting again today. I mean, this is it here. There's 5 or 6 days left, and if they can, they're not going to push it till Thursday. I mean, that's why there's a mediator in New York now, and they're trying to, you know, hammer out every single deal. Pardon me, every single issue of that memorandum of understanding that we talked about last week, Drew, when you were in Kentucky. And it's coming down to how long is the CBA going to be? Okay, we know it's probably going to, they've both agreed it's going to be 10 years. But the major things, what's going to be the cap in 2013, 2014? That's huge. And there's a lot of things, you know, that still need to be addressed that they haven't agreed on. But I have to believe that every day that goes by, they're coming to an agreement on the major things. And today, that's why I think the mediator is there to make sure that, you know, they stay on track. And from what we've heard, that the mediator has actually been very helpful these last few days, as opposed to the, you know, last month, when it was really kind of a sham.
But that's no fault of the mediator. Last month,
no, not at all.
These guys just didn't have any, I mean, they should have had incentive to make a deal. At least the players certainly should have had incentive to make a deal. But neither side wanted to make a deal, and so now, as we talked about on the show, months ago, they're deadline hunting. And guess what? The deadline is close. The deadline is
here.
Very
close.
I mean, that's why this deal is getting done. Is there's no, you know, you've reached the point of no return.
That's right.
So I mean, once you reach that point, you gotta go one way or the other. Right. And they're trying their best to go the way that hockey fans and they should want.
It's really amazing though that they talk about the shadow mediation. And people need to understand, when you're having shuttle meetings, generally speaking, shuttle meetings are because the parties can't be in the same room together. And that is just incredible to comprehend, that these people cannot be in the same room together negotiating.
You're saying the best negotiations with a mediator involved happen with both sides are at the same table?
Both sides, mediation or not, need to be at the same table. I mean, I guess, you know, mediation is going to have... I'm not... that will versus in mediation, so I'm going to qualify that. And I don't know exactly what it is. My point is more so, Drew, that these parties cannot be in the same room together.
Imagine what it was like in 2004, 2005 between Goodnow and Bettman, if this is what it's like. I mean, it's unbelievable to think that...
You shouldn't need a mediator, as you first of all.
No,
you shouldn't need
no.
a mediator at this point in time.
No.
And it's going to be helpful, etc. But it's amazing to me that these parties need mediation.
Well, it's funny.
At this late in the game, I think mediation is important. But I think that at this point in the game, when they're that close, that they still need mediation, shows you that they can't even be in a room trusting each other to negotiate.
Well, it's funny that this week we've read that, you know, it's funny Dennis Bayak mentioned that, but it seems like from 1 hour to the next, we don't know if there's going to be a season. There isn't going to be a season. It goes from positive to negative in almost like a second. But it's so funny. I still don't look at the relationship between the NHL and the NHLPA as an all-time low. I think the all-time low was the last lockout.
Mm.
But if we're at an all-time low now, I think this lockout has put the entire hockey industry at an all-time low. But it's funny, you know, if we're not at an all-time low now between the NHL and the NHLPA, we're not that far off from it.
I think that even though there'll probably going to be a season this year, I think the vitriol and the anger involved in this negotiation is greater than in 2004-2005. And now that also could be very much a function of Twitter.
Not only that,
and the social media and how we hear so much more from everybody all the time.
So much more that we really shouldn't be hearing.
Of course. In an ideal negotiation, you know, we don't know any of this stuff.
Well, the idea that, you know, as he talks about, and Dennis spoke about the minute-by-minute and second-by-second changes, that's all sources, though, right? That's the PA giving to one source, NHL giving to the other source, and trying to spin it so they can have more leverage.
There's a lot of nonsense out there, Richie.
Sure, there is a lot of nonsense. But, Drew, I think it is worse because, you know, the whole mantra in 2004-05 was, we're going to try and fix the game. We're going to try and fix the game and get a cap. So the fans went along with it, understandably so, in many cases. And anyhow, you also had a plan when you came back. We're going to change the game. We're going to take out hooking and holding. We're going to make it pay back to the fans. Now, they don't have time to do that. So the fans are paying the price. I mean, they're probably going to come out and maybe, you know, Pierre LeBrun's mentioned free center ice and all that stuff. Putting more hockey is not necessarily going to make people happier. I mean, people are turning away from hockey. They're not going to watch their team, never mind Nashville Columbus on a Thursday.
The free center ice package is a nice idea. But
they have to do something for the fans.
That's going to do absolutely nothing for...
Can you imagine if they have exhibition games and they charge people for those games?
That would be appalling.
Like, I mean, at least, you know, to the NBA's credit, when they've had their lockouts, they've had free exhibition games. I mean, people don't, you know, it's already appalling that people have to pay for an exhibition game, you know, during, you know, when there's no lockout hanging over it, there's no CBA negotiations. Can you imagine if they try and play one exhibition game, or, I mean, they can't play more than that, maybe two at the absolute most, and they try and charge people for those games?
But Drew, that would be the
biggest PR blunder of this entire debacle.
A free exhibition game or a center ice schedule. I mean, it's laughable. I mean, the way the NHL and the NHLPA have presented themselves and negotiated has been an insult to everyone involved with the hockey world. So that's why I think there's so much pressure from sponsors, the media, to get this deal done, not to mention the fact that the players and the owners themselves are putting pressure on their representatives to get a deal done here, because it has been that embarrassing. And, you know, you might be right when you say this lockout was worse, even though this lockout might end up only being a half season as opposed to 2004, which was a full season. The way, you know, everything has happened, you know, has just been, I mean, what are there any words to describe this lockout even anymore? Oh. I mean, it's been so
disgraceful.
Disgraceful
is the nicest word I can think of. Most of the other words I think of, I don't think I can say on radio.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, we've gone through, you know, the early December press conference and all that. So I think everyone is just like, oh, okay, whatever the cap is, whatever the variance is, you know, whatever the contract term limits are, just, you know, get it done and I want to watch hockey. I mean, I think people are, even though, you know, we're bringing the news to everybody and having people on like James Myrtle, I mean, people want to be talking about actual hockey on the ice and you know, talking about who's got a good team, who's going to make the playoffs in a shortened season, you know, are the Jets moving to the Western Conference, as opposed to, you know, how much money these guys are going to get in the 2013-2014 season. So again, it might actually be the case that when we look back on this, you know, was worse than the previous lockout, which we know was god awful.
It's bad. I mean, you know, I'm just glad we're almost at the end of it. Really,
well, this is the last week, because by next week, if they haven't settled on this show, then the season's over, and we'll go into talking about who scored at Varsity View Community Center in the 14-year-old game.
Yeah.
And no, in all honesty, that next week is we're on the air. Either there's a season or there's not.
That's right.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
And at least you'll have at least we'll be able to know one way or the other.
One way or the other.
Yeah. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the last issues that they're negotiating over. You know, we know the answer is compromise, but why they don't know that or why they haven't agreed to it yet is a separate issue altogether. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Actually, what am I talking about? Grant Sonnier is up next. We'll talk about World Juniors with Grant Sonnier. We'll talk about the other thing after. You're listening to TSN 1290.